proceed to the second case for argument, the United States versus Bethel, et al.
May it please the court, I'm attorney Pat Stengel. I represent Julian Bethel in this matter. As the court is aware,
before you start, Mr. Stengel, are you possessed of a copy of the letter sent to the clerk of the court, received, I guess, last night, indicating Mr. Bethel's concern about the argument?
I have not received that, Your Honor, no.
You have not?
No.
Well, I want you to be aware of that. Do we have another copy? This obviously won't be charged to your time. Tonight, I don't want you to be precluded from viewing this correspondence, so you may wish to have a...
I can show them a copy. Thank you, Your Honor. I have had an opportunity to review it. Is the Chief Judge looking for my response?
Well, if you have one, I'm not obviously mandating it, but
sure.
If you have one, Mr. Stengel.
Well, I don't think there's any question that he disagrees with my position. How the court wishes for me to proceed or how the court wishes to handle any further appellate action, which he may want to pursue pro se.
I'm inclined to offer Mr. Bethel some additional time to file a pleading speaking to any points he deems appropriate, and give a short response time to the government, and that's the procedural posture that I envision. But that in no way is to preclude you making any representations on his behalf this morning.
Thank you, Chief Judge Schwamp. I think, quite frankly, under the circumstances, that would be the appropriate way to proceed. As the court is aware, I filed a motion to take judicial notice of the Bissonnette case, which Judge Mannion is quite familiar. My position is clear. I simply don't believe there's any further merit. This case came down on February 20th of 2002. During the briefing schedule in this case, it's directly in opposite to the very argument that I raised. Unless the court has any further questions of me or my position or analysis, I would simply defer to Mr. Mandel to continue with his argument.
I assume that Judge Mannion, Judge Wynn, do you have no further questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Stengel, and thank you for, you were appointed in this case?
Yes.
And thank you for the representation you've afforded Mr. Bethel.
My pleasure,
today.
Thank you.
We, in line with my comments of a few moments ago, will allow Mr. Bethel 21 days to file any pleadings that he deems appropriate in regard to this case, and will permit the government 10 days for a response.
But I can also advise him of that in writing.
If
as well.
If you would, I would appreciate it, and that would be in keeping with the professional way you've handled the case today.
I will do so. Thank you, Chief Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Stengel. All right. Mr. Mandel.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm David Mandel, and I am going to be arguing for both of the Hassos in this matter. The district court was mistaken in its findings. I believe that it didn't properly apply the standards from Hobson and from Escobar. There was no credible evidence in the record to support his finding that the battery and the conspiracy were severable into two distinct offenses, unlike the facts in Hobson. The facts presented to the court were uncontested by the government, pretrial services, and the defendant that the state battery conviction was related to the conspiracy and in furtherance of it. According to Mr. O'Shea's letter of July 23rd to the court, in the last paragraph he notes, the refusal to store marijuana need not be the sole or even dominant reason for attacking Ibarra. The bottom line was the attack was part of the marijuana distribution, accordingly it's part of relevant conduct. When I sent my initial letter to pretrial services on July 2nd, I was trying to avoid a two-level increase under USSG 2D1B1, that argument was immediately rejected by pretrial services, who informed me that they had that Mr. Ibarra had been re-interviewed and had linked his attack directly to the marijuana and the conspiracy. I abandoned that position immediately, and in fact, I had not been provided those interview statements at the time I wrote my July 2nd letter. We filed our formal objections to the court, and we raised the issue that we believed that he should not get that criminal history point under the Hobson-Escobar analysis. It's unclear, it's speculative in the court's decision whether the government would or would not have tried to have proved that the Ibarra incident should the matter have gone to trial. However, immediately after being arrested, all of the defendants in the case started to cooperate, be interviewed, and the case didn't proceed in those normal channels. In the Western District, we don't use speaking indictments, so the court's referral to the fact that there was nothing in the indictment raising the Ibarra incident is not surprising, since they use a bare-bones indictment. There was no proof, there were no motions in limine or anything else, since everybody was trying to get a 5K1 and intended to plea as early as possible in the case. The state criminal complaint that the court also relies upon predated the conspiracy investigation and charges by a number of years, and at the time of that incident, Ibarra was not about to admit his involvement in a large-scale marijuana conspiracy, so that's why that criminal complaint was silent on any connection to the drug dealing, which the court relied on as part of its decision at the time of sentencing. I believe that the government waived argument by the position it took in its reply brief on this Hobson analysis. There were no facts in the PSR showing Ibarra beating was not in furtherance. The court ignored the facts in the pre-sentence report, the government's letter, to base its decision in the application of the guidelines. And the defendant's statements throughout the course of this case did not bear any indicia of reliability. The court did not find a single other statement of any of the defendants to be credible, and because of those reasons, I believe that the court committed clear error. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. The issue presented by Mr. Mandel on behalf of Mr. Yasso Jr. is whether Judge Shabazz committed clear error in finding, as he did, that the battery in question was not part of relevant conduct of the charge conspiracy. And what Mr. Mandel glosses over here and ignored in the district court is that as the attorney for Mr. Ibarra, he took a factual position that directly undercut the position he's taking here before this court. To briefly review the factual posture that was in front of Judge Shabazz at the time of sentencing, the facts were limited. There was no hearing. There was no hearing requested by any party. There was no live testimony on the issue. This is not a case that went to trial, so the court was going off the written proposed findings of fact in the pre-sentence report. There's really just two paragraphs that are germane to this issue, paragraph 22 and paragraph 109 in Yasso Senior's brief. It's the same paragraph really as 108 in Yasso Junior's brief. Those facts showed that the beating in question, well, first of all, that Mr. Ibarra began living rent-free in Mr. Yasso Senior's DeForest home and stored marijuana there prior to 1997. That sometime in December of 97, Mr. Ibarra told Mr. Yasso Sr. that he was uncomfortable with that arrangement and did not want to store marijuana, and Mr. Yasso Sr. Became angry. And then around Christmas of 1997, another one of the Yassos, Raul Yasso, informed Mr. Ibarra that the reason he was allowed to live there rent-free was because of his willingness to store marijuana. It wasn't until 6 months later, according to these uncontested facts, that the battery occurred at a park in Sun Prairie outside of Madison. And again, the facts in the PSR indicate that Mr. Ibarra had been accused of being a stool pigeon, and the very next sentence is that Mr. Ibarra was aware that Mr. Yasso Sr. was wanted for a murder charge in Laredo. And by the way, that was a 1993 murder charge. The record indicates that it was drug-related, but there's nothing to suggest it was connected with the conspiracy charge in this case, which began in 1995.
At the time of that battery, was he still living in the house? He said it was 6 months later than the...
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Perhaps Mr. Mandel can address that. From the record, I'm not sure.
It matters. I'm just curious whether he was still in there when you're talking about being related versus some other reason.
I would also like to note that in that battery charge was a state battery charge in Dane County, which is the county where Madison and where Sun Prairie sits. And in that criminal case, Mr. Yasso Jr. was represented by Mr. Mandel, the very same attorney who represented him in the trial court in this case. Now, that is the record in the PSR, but I think the crucial point and the point that really puts the issue over the top, I think, is that in July of 2000, Mr. Mandel took a factual position as the attorney for his client. It wasn't an argument, as he characterizes it here. It was a factual position. If you look at his July 2nd letter, he very succinctly said that the battery in which he represented Mr. Yasso had nothing to do with marijuana distribution. In fact, he alleges factually that it had to do with because of derogatory comments that Mr. Ibarra had made about the family. Now, given that record, the government did recommend in front of Judge Sabaz that the court not find that it was related conduct. That is not inconsistent with the position that we're taking here, that the court's finding was not clear error. They are, of course, two separate issues. The fact that the prosecutor may have decided the case differently doesn't matter. The question whether another judge might have decided it differently doesn't matter. The question before this court is whether the record supports Judge Shabazz's findings, that is there a factual evidentiary foundation for it under a clear error standard? And I submit, given all of those facts, particularly given the defendant's factual assertion that his findings are supported by the record, there are not only are there sufficient facts, but if you look at the reasons behind the defendant's flip-flop in his statement, I think it also supports Judge Shabazz's findings. And I think as a trier of fact, one would ask, where's the motive to lie? Where's the motive to fabricate? And the stakes were highest when the defense apparently realized that by arguing that the battery was unrelated to the drug conspiracy, they were really hurting themselves and that the consequence would be a higher criminal history category. And it's only when that realization dawned on them that they took a different factual position and argued instead that they were in fact related. So looking at when the motive to fabricate, or the motive for a defendant to lie, I think that supports Judge Shabazz's decision. I think it's important, too, to note that both the Yassos, junior and senior, took the same position. They corroborate each other, which supports the inference that they were telling the truth when they said that the beating was not related to the marijuana distribution. And finally, again, and most importantly, there's the admission by Mr. Yasso Jr.'s attorney that the beating was unrelated to the marijuana distribution.
Well, they imply that they think that Judge Shabazz was just going to say, okay, you want to pull one on me, I'm going to drill you with it. I mean, I get the impression that they think that he was doing this not because he necessarily believed him the first time and second, but just to show that he's not going to get jerked around either.
I certainly don't draw, nor would I pretend to draw that inference. By my reading of Judge Shabazz's comments, after the arguments of counsel, I think it's clear that he felt that despite what was being argued to him by the lawyers, that the reality was that it was unrelated. And he put particular emphasis, both in his oral comments and in his written judgment and commitment order, on the fact that there had been this factual flip-flop by the defense. He also noted that he drew other inferences from the facts as well. I don't think there's anything in the record to suggest that Judge Shabazz was made this finding in order to...
No, there wouldn't be. I mean, the record seems clear. There's a choice.
Yes, and that's the essence of it, Your Honor. There is a choice. There's two permissible views of the evidence. And the fact that the prosecution argued for and asked the court to draw one inference doesn't mean that the court committed clear error in drawing the other. If there are no further questions, then thank you.
Thank you, Senator Mandel.
Thank you. I'd like to clarify a few statements by the government. The assistant U.S. attorney on the case took the factual position, as well as pretrial services, that the beating of Ibarra was directly related to the conspiracy, that there were maybe a number of reasons for the beating, including the reasons given by Hasso Jr. and Hasso Sr., but those don't have to be the exclusive reason. And they should be bound by their statements. They made their statements to the district court and at the time of sentencing. I made my statement in a letter to pretrial services on July 2nd, long before the sentencing, when I didn't have complete information, I didn't have the re-interview of Mr. Ibarra to base my statement on, and we had a motive to try and get out from under the two-point gun enhancement. We objected for this incident, and we also were objecting to the gun found at his mother's house to avoid the two-point. I was immediately contacted by pretrial services, told of these new investigative reports that I had not been provided when Mr. Ibarra explained the true reason for the beating that occurred. I abandoned that position immediately. The government agreed, pretrial services agreed, and we presented the same factual position to the court at the time of sentencing. The facts that the court relied on were not supported by the record. There was no quick flip-flop. I changed my position within 3 days of my July 2nd letter. As you note in my July 2nd letter, I was leaving on vacation in a couple days. It was right before the 4th of July. I dictated. It didn't get typed to the following week. But our position changed immediately upon learning that Mr. Ibarra had been re-interviewed and the facts showed that this was related. I represented Mr. Hasso Jr. in the lower circuit court, state court, on the battery charge. At that time, there was no mention of any marijuana conspiracy. There was no investigation. So I was relying in some part on the information I had gleaned years earlier when marijuana wasn't even mentioned. Yasso Sr. argued that Ibarra was unreliable and gave another reason for the attack, but nobody suggested, I think, by the time of sentencing that the attack was anything but in furtherance of the conspiracy, or at least one of the motives for the attack was in furtherance of the conspiracy.
I had asked one question he thought maybe you could better answer, and that is the time relationship, apparently 6 months after the, I don't know what you call it, a confrontation, where he says he doesn't want the marijuana in the garage anymore, and they say, well, that's why you get the free rent. Then this battery took place 6 months later. Was he still in the house? Or do you know?
I'm not 100% sure, Your Honor. I think he may have been, but I think there was also concerns that he was going to inform on them in their marijuana distribution. He was initially involved in the marijuana distribution business himself, and they had had a falling out among a number of things related to that conspiracy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mandel, and our thanks to all counsel, and Mr. Mandel, thanks from the court. This is, you take this on appointment.
That's correct.
The court appreciates your accepting and representing your client in the fashion you have.
And thank you for bearing with me.
The court will take a short 5-minute recess.